Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Devil We Know is sponsored by Podcorn, the amazing marketplace designed to help podcasters of all sizes get sponsored the way they want. I've been using Podcorn for a couple weeks now. It's real easy. You just log on, scroll through the many advertisers, send them a message why your podcast would be great to advertise on, and then you're off to the races. Creative control and transparency are the name of the game. Podcorn believes in leaving power in the hands of the creatives, and with their vast marketplace of sponsors with different needs, it's easy for any podcaster to find the deal that works best for them. Start with Podcorn now by following the link in our show notes and find a sponsor today. Just go to podcorn.com to get started.
You are listening to Devil We Know, a true crime podcast, which may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of this show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
Dressed in tan jail clothes, 19-year-old David Graham walked into court and took a seat beside his attorney. Minutes later, his fiancée, 18-year-old Diane Zamora, appeared in the same courtroom. The action came just hours after the pair was indicted on capital murder charges in connection with the killing of 16-year-old Adrian Jones.
They're bright, very bright. They know how to plan, think, and kill.
I believe my client is bright. It is articulate, is an accomplished individual who is not capable of planning out an execution.
Graham's attorney Dan Cogdale says his client maintains his innocence despite a handwritten confession.
And I will do everything within my being to attack A, the admissibility, and B, the accuracy of that statement.
On the heels of the indictments comes another announcement, this one perhaps the bigger development. Prosecutors say at the request of Adrian Jones's parents, they will not seek the death penalty in this case.
They know what the pain is like to lose a child. They go through it daily. They want us to waive the death penalty, seek a life sentence, and have these folks sit in jail for as long as humanly possible.
I think that's very admirable on their part.
Zamora's attorney says there will be no plea bargain in this case, and despite what's going on, both attorneys say their clients continue to communicate through letters and are still in love. Deborah Ferguson, Texas News 5.
In this episode of Devil We Know, a pair of teenage lovers awash in the honeymoon phase of their new relationship take dire measures after the boy has his own tryst with a sophomore girl named Adrian. What started as simple puppy love soon became a sick obsession, and the cruel couple took a victim in the heat of their lustful deeds. Tarrant County, a proudly historical area of North Texas, is home to good old Cowtown, or Fort Worth, one of the key sites of the 19th century cattle drives. Today, that plays just one part of what is now a bustling mix of urban, suburban, and agricultural landscapes that have seen staggering growth in the past 30 years. But before a lot of that growth took place, the people that lived there saw a lot of down-home traditions passed down, especially in high school, from the mums at homecoming to the Friday night football games. There was a lot to expect of high school in the 1990s, but one thing that no one expected of their high schoolers was murder. Diane Michelle Zamora was a Texan born and bred, reared by parents Theodore and Gloria Zamora. Diane, born in 1978, was to be the oldest of four siblings total. And the house was not only a full one, it was a busy one. Theodore was an electrician and her mother a registered nurse. So a lot of weight imaginably fell on the shoulders of young Diane. But it wasn't without its benefits. Diane learned a lot about hard work and applying herself from the family in which she was raised. And she took that knowledge with her to Crowley High School, where she graduated as an honor student. She was known, at least by her beau-to-be, as bubbly and spontaneous, with a spirited sense of determination, especially regarding getting what she wanted. She ran cross-country, played flute in the marching band, and still somehow found time to earn the grades that eventually got her a scholarship at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. It was all in pursuit of a dream, of course. She wanted to be an astronaut, and with her literal and figurative track record, that dream seemed to be a possibility. Meanwhile, she worked in a teenage clothing store called Fast Forward, but it was through her loftier pursuits, which came early on, that she found what really became a big part of her future. Diane, while at a Civil Air Patrol meeting in 1991, met the future love of her life, David Graham. David Christopher Graham, born in November of 77 to Jerry and Janice Graham, was also from a family that had produced four children. David, the baby of the family, didn't get to experience the family as a whole for as long as the rest. Jerry, who was a principal at a local school, and Janice, a schoolteacher herself, began the process of divorce later on, leaving David to eventually live full-time with his father. David, though, was the master of his own future, and much like Diane, he made a name for himself at his own school with top grades, a spot on the Mansfield High cross country team, and his own dreams of being a pilot. It seems that the two were indeed meant for each other, as David even was to begin his career with a military academy as well. The Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, to be exact. After the two met, Diane and David engendered a slowly, steadily growing relationship over close to 4 years that resulted in an official first date in August of 1995. The two were still in their teens, but that didn't stop them from taking the next steps only a month later. They very quickly developed a serious relationship and became engaged officially in the month of September. To accomplish this, though, David sold some of his own firearms to place a down payment on the ring. Strangely, though, their date wasn't set for the next week, or even the next year. Instead, the young couple agreed on having their wedding on August 13th, 2000. But it wasn't all roses for the young couple. In fact, the relationship itself was described by some later as obsessive and all-consuming, at least on one side. It was especially true of Diane. And for David, the feelings soon became altogether different. He was described as having two sets of personalities, one inside the relationship and one exclusively outside of it. Around his wife-to-be, David was reportedly cold and unresponsive. Without Diane around, however, he was said to be quite likable. Diane, though, was different. Her feelings about David were abundantly clear to all, but she didn't act on them in the way that many young couples do, for a while at least. Diane heeded the message of her religious upbringing, stating that she would save her virginity for when she married David. However, that resolve didn't last, and the two did consummate their relationship pretty soon after she claimed the intention of chastity. This act, as often true with young couples, made Diane even more sure of her connection with David. She was soon to be attached to him at the hip, seemingly everyone saying, "If I can't be Mrs. David Graham, then I will die as Miss Diane Zamora." She was, in a word, devoted. As for David, devotion was a fickle thing. So fickle, in fact, that his devotion began to sway when he got to know another woman named Adrienne a little too well. Adrienne Jones, daughter of Linda Sue and Bill Jones, was a sophomore at Mansfield High School in the fall of 1995. Known commonly as AJ, Adrienne's family also consisted of two brothers, Justin and Scott, along with three dogs. She was a lover of animals, and she was considered quite popular for her age, reportedly known to do anything to put her friends in a good mood. Her prowess as a student was great, an honor student all the way, and her progress as an athlete was also considerable, as she had spent time both playing soccer and running cross country. She worked hard at a restaurant called Golden Fried Chicken, where the customers all loved her, and it was clear that her future was bright. Her goal was to begin her college education at Texas A&M University, and to exercise her love for animals as a veterinarian. All that to say, she not only had quite a life ahead of her, but she also was making impressive strides in high school. It's no wonder, then, that she even made an impression on an already engaged David Graham. The magnetic personality that David was said to have when he wasn't around Diane likely played a big part, but he and the 15-year-old Adrienne were already acquainted by the time that November 4th, 1995 rolled around. The two had just participated in a cross-country track meet for the school, and David gave Adrienne a ride home afterward. As they neared the house, Adrienne reportedly told David to go in another direction. They soon found themselves parking behind an elementary school, where the two had a sexual encounter that Adrienne never spoke of again. It was, at least the time, thought to be a one-time thing, and to speak of it would be to become the talk of less than 600 classmates. In small suburban towns of the 90s, it was better off just to keep quiet. David, though, did no such thing. After the affair, the affianced boy went to his future bride to spill the beans. No sooner than he'd done that, Diane wanted to arrange a meeting with Adrienne. According to her, there was a talk to be had. David agreed and decided to make the arrangements. Almost a month after the events of David's tryst with Adrienne, he called her once more, under the guise of wanting to hook up again. Adrienne agreed, and David asked her to sneak out with him outside of her house. This occurred at about 12:30, now marking an exact month since their last rendezvous, early December 4th. David drove to Adrienne's house, picking her up and taking her to what he called a secluded location on Seton Road in Mansfield, Texas. Nearby was Joe Pool Lake, a regular hotspot for fishing in the summer months. But now, all was quiet. The two were seemingly all alone. The surprise came as Diane climbed out of the hatchback and into the back seat, and suddenly, a fight broke out. Now, the original plan was sinister for sure. Diane and David had agreed previously to breaking the miner's neck and taking her into the lake, where weights would sink her body. When the fighting began, though, this plan was tossed, and the young couple panicked, rationalizing that this was going to be, in their minds, her or us. Diane took this opportunity to hit Adrienne with a weight. The hit connected, still managed to escape the car, running as fast as she could to escape the rabid twosome that had trapped her. But trapped she still was. She had found herself at odds with a barbed wire fence, and in her attempt to clear it, she was eventually overtaken. She had collapsed in the field just beyond, with tiny puncture wounds in her legs, where the barbs had taken a hold of her. As she laid in the field, David came closer to her, and he pulled a gun on her. It was here that David shot her twice in the head, before leaving her dead in the field just off of Seton Road. The couple, awash in adrenaline, told each other, "I love you," with Diane finishing by saying, "We shouldn't have done that. We shouldn't have done that, David." It was clear, at least in Diane's eyes, whose fault the crime really was. She never seemed to forget the reason why David went to get Adrienne in the first place, and yet it was her call to make. After killing Adrienne at Diane's behest, David drove them to a friend's house, where David was able to change out of his clothes to some borrowed ones. He took the soiled clothes to a dumpster near Diane's house, and then the two drove to Diane's place shortly after. David, while his fiancée cleaned her car of evidence, threw up loudly and later joined Diane in her room, where the two spent the night. Only after that did David finally take his weights and the gun back to his house, though he and Diane were never seen far away from each other after that. The two also swore each other in secrecy, maintaining a mutual sense of ignorance in regards to the crime they committed that night. That was the moment of renewal to them, of their cruel and twisted devotions to each other. First, an obsession that carried far too long into their youth. Now, though, the same mutual obsession had led to worse consequences than ever thought would occur. And it was up to them to keep it a secret for all of their lives. The morning of the 4th was a hard and confusing one for the Jones household, even before they knew what had happened. At 6 a.m. in the morning, Adrian's mom, Linda Sue, could hear her daughter's alarm going off incessantly. She walked in to turn off the alarm, only to find no sign of Adrian in her bedroom. At first, this seemed like a simple misunderstanding. Surely, Linda Sue thought, Adrian was just taking an early morning jog. However, soon, Adrian's ride to school came and went, and worry began to settle in. Only a little after 8 a.m., Adrian's mom called Mansfield High School to see if her daughter was there. But she wasn't. Linda remembered the night before that Adrian received a call from David and that he was extremely upset. Linda then tried to call all of the Davids that she could find in her daughter's address book. Then Linda called the police to be on the lookout for her teenage daughter. But that wasn't the only call that police got. A man driving out near Seton Road made a call of his own when he spotted what looked like a body in a nearby field. The body was wearing shorts, a sweatshirt, and no shoes. Sure enough, the police made it there and found Adrian's body. It was clear that this was no accident either. Two gunshot wounds and the wounds of a woman on the run told a very different story. The Grand Prairie Police Department had jurisdiction over the body due to the location in which it was found. They also had the difficult task of informing the Jones family. Linda Jones states that her husband went with the Grand Prairie detectives to identify the body. She further states that the family was in complete disbelief and nobody wanted to believe it was true. After the body was found, the police made their way across the town of Mansfield to uncover what they believed to be a heinous crime by a schoolmate. They even found someone to pin the murder on, so to speak, holding a boy named Brian McMillan in custody while they struggled to put the whole case together. They had no real evidence to connect Brian to the murder, but they held him in custody for 3 weeks. The police were allegedly pressuring him to make a full-on confession regarding what happened to Adrian. We will be right back after these short messages. I spend most of my time reading up on true crime and finding new ways to bring you the most chilling stories. But when I want to take myself away from the world of deadly killers, I like to make time for fun. The way I do that is by pulling out my phone and playing the puzzle game known as Best Fiends. With Best Fiends, you can solve the puzzles anywhere, engaging your brain and getting to take on challenges of all kinds. Best of all, it's a casual game. You can put it back down when you need to and start the game again without skipping a beat. Whether it's just for the level you're on, or whether it's to tell people like me your favorite character is Gordon the Scorpion, Best Fiends is a game you can easily share and enjoy talking about on social media as well. In the past few weeks, I've made it all the way to level 438. I've been working, of course, but the thing is, I can pick it up and put down Best Fiends whenever I want. I've been playing after long shifts at work or even after recording my podcast. When I have a free moment and want to charge my brain a bit with some fun activity, playing this game takes the cake, and it sure beats hanging out on the internet all day. There's no need for an internet connection, so I am able to play even when I'm flying from place to place or when I'm in a place with no signal. I can't help but watch the game too. It's all fun and lively in a way that makes the world of true crime even fade away for a few minutes. And the game doesn't get boring.
because there's always more content coming in every month to keep me interested. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R, Best Fiends. Friends without the R, Best Fiends.
However, Brian knew better, and since he had nothing to do with the killing, he told the police just as much. He would then go on to take a polygraph test and pass it, whereupon he was then released. His family went on to sue the Grand Prairie Police Department. Eventually, they would settle out of court for an undisclosed amount of money. While poor Brian was being roped unwillingly into the death of a classmate, there was more planning afoot by the real high school killers. The police were on the right track looking for someone at Mansfield High. But given that there had been no real indications of a relationship between David and Adrian, it seemed a moot point, just another friendship cut too short. While this discovery was being made, David and Diane, who had also been considered somewhat obsessive and codependent, acted even more so after the events of Adrian's death. Not only did they constantly talk about each other, but they also had to have each other's ear almost all of the time. In person, on the phone, it didn't matter. The two had become the epitome of the word inseparable. David even made good on the ring payments so that Diane could finally wear it. It seemed that they were going to make the most of their upcoming marriage plans, as though they were normal, law-abiding adults. Little to the knowledge of the paranoid couple, police stayed focused, following up on dozens of so-called leads on the murder, turning up with very little to go on, but they remained vigilant. And it was easy to see that this horrific death couldn't go unsolved. Adrian's parents, though, felt the effects of the lack of answers, with her father Bill remarking that he thought it unlikely that they'd ever find the killer, let alone go to trial, said Linda, who believed strongly that the police would eventually make good on their search. But unfortunately, they still had a daughter to bury. Adrian's family held a funeral service just 3 days after her murder, but there was another service held by the school near the track here. It's said that David, who was in attendance as a schoolmate, appeared tearful. That said, suspicion didn't lay on David for long. The police knew, of course, that they were looking for a murderer, and since Adrian was popular in the school, they had a long laundry list of suspects. As for David, they questioned him, but he soon was quickly dismissed, as the affair between him and Adrienne was not public knowledge. Soon the couple believed that they were going to be able to live a quiet life, unperturbed by the events that unfolded soon after. Both of them graduated in the spring of 96, and the two were accepted into their respective schools of interest. The United States Naval Academy had offered Diane a full scholarship after all, and David made his way to the Air Force Academy as well. Life went on as if the murder had never happened, and although their mutual obsession grew as a result, Diane proved much more erratic in her affections. They wrote each other every day, and if David didn't respond to her emails within 24 hours, she would have a fit. Diane was constantly worried that her husband-to-be was cheating on her, and she even tried to make David jealous by saying a guy named Jay Guild had kissed her. In his emails, though, David would remind Diane about what binds us together. It seems to be enough to placate her increasingly worrisome behavior for a time, but that time grew short. While at the academy, Jay Guild, the guy that Diane claimed kissed her, asked Diane if David had ever cheated on her. Diane, now awash in her irrational thoughts, said yes, and that she had asked David to kill the girl. Jay, though, thought Diane was just being dramatic and didn't report it. It wasn't the last time that Diane would share these details of the event that David said bound them together. In fact, far from it. In August of 1996, Diane told her fellows at the academy, Christina Mason and Jennifer McKierney, that she and David had planned the death of Adrian Jones. It was then that McKierney told the officers at the academy. Those officers, in turn, notified the police department of the city of Grand Prairie, Texas. To her surprise, though, the police then visited Diane at the academy, where she got uncharacteristically tight-lipped. The secrecy into which she was sworn had finally come back to the forefront of her mind. And the detectives would later say that Diane met them with no emotion and had little reaction to why the detectives were there in the first place. Detectives say her reaction and emotions were what someone would call the thousand-yard stare. Detectives would leave Annapolis determined to find the evidence they needed. Diane was placed on leave soon after, and she flew to Colorado to see David. Apparently, no one knows what happened during this trip, but a friend did take their picture, and it is reported that they looked like they knew they were caught and that they wouldn't see each other again. After her sojourn to Colorado Springs, Diane flew back to Texas, and on September 3rd, David was visited by the police as well, who followed up on the information they got on Diane. David, for his part, agreed to a polygraph after denying all involvement in the death of Adrian. The next day, the polygraph was done and the results of the test spoke for themselves. The authorities told David that he had done poorly in several areas, after which David asked to speak with police in a more private area. When they obliged, David began giving way more information than before. He told them firstly that he had lured Adrian out of her house and that Diane had been in the car. There was a bit that David was still holding back, though. For a few hours, David refused to tell police what he had hit Adrian with, and he essentially kept forcing the police to play the guessing game. The police grew very frustrated at this point, and at around 12:20 a.m. on September 5th, they showed David the arrest warrant proving that Diane had been arrested. "David, just write us something," the detectives pleaded, after assuring David that the chance of getting the death penalty was more than a possibility. After that scare, they told him that a confession would help grease the wheels a bit, that it would help the court go easy on him. Convinced, David began typing up his side of the story in excruciating detail. He described his meaningless and painful sexual encounter with Adrian Jones, and he continued by telling them the reaction that Diane had after this happened, which apparently was a result of her womanly vengeance that would only be sated by the violence they soon wrought upon the sophomore. David also delivered details of the night of Adrian's death, as well a night which Diane had told the police she didn't remember. He confirmed that he had shot Adrian twice with a 9mm. He told police later that he had hid it in his dad's attic. When the trials finally began for the two killer youths, the court moved proceedings to New Braunfels, far south of Mansfield, there to honor the wishes of Adrian's grieving family. The trial went on without pursuit of capital punishment. The Jones family didn't want to see two more mothers experience the pain of losing their children. But the trials did go on separately for the two of them, and that proved to be even more telling of the lengths to which each young killer was willing to go. For months, the two seemingly joined at the hip began to spring surprise attacks at one another, making the case a very difficult one to resolve. Everything from details to motive seemed to change from hearing to hearing, in a frightening array that was only eventually put to rest years later. At David's trial, his defense argued that Diane, in fact, had been the one to pull the trigger. The idea was that David's initial confession had simply been out of love and devotion to his wife-to-be. During Diane's trial, however, the story differed greatly. Diane said that she just wanted to talk to Adrian about the affair that occurred between David and her a month before. She had not planned to kidnap, murder, or hurt Adrian. And she stated that she only hid in the car because she was afraid Adrian wouldn't have gotten in the car if she saw Diane in there. She testified that she did not tell David to kill Adrian, nor did she know of his plan to kill her. But she did confess to hitting Adrian with the weight. Diane also said that she stayed in the car while David shot Adrian. To counter her story, though, her fellows from the academy once again came out of the woodwork. Christina Mason testified that Diane told David to shoot her, kill her, shoot her, as Adrian laid in the field. Meanwhile, Jennifer McKierney testified that Diane told her that the murder was planned, that David killed Adrian to make up for what had happened. It was clear here that Diane meant the affair. But it wasn't over yet. Diane made more appeals to how very controlling she made David out to be. With her next bout on the stand being used as an opportunity to talk how demanding he was of sexual favors. In her testimony, Diane stated that David's demands amount to a daily average of 4 separate sexual encounters, with some days with even higher bars. Diane claimed that his daily quota would at times amount to 6 or 7. She even alleged in this newest development, much to the disbelief of the court, that David was so controlling that he even made Diane perform sexual acts with a gun that she said he used to kill Adrian. Her attempt in court was even recorded and reported upon, showing the measures to which she was going to alleviate herself of the crime's burden.
Diane Zamore described first a home life with financial struggles and marital problems between her mom and dad. She choked up as she talked of her 3 younger siblings.
Polly Zamora, he's 6.
Zamora excelled in school and was appointed to the U.S. Naval Academy, a step towards her goal of becoming an astronaut. It was those similar interests that pulled her to David Graham in the late summer of 95.
What attracted you to David Graham?
His brain.
She described Graham's caring attention when she was hospitalized with a severe injury to her left hand, but she also testified of a violent relationship where Graham constantly demanded sex.
An average of 4 times a day, up to 6 or 7.
Did David indicate to you that you had no choice about this?
Yes, sir.
Did David do anything physically to you with that 9mm Makarov?
Yes, sir. He tried shoving it between my legs and he put it in my mouth.
Zamora says in December 95, Graham told her he had had sex with another girl, 16-year-old Adrian Jones of Mansfield. Zamora says Graham blamed the teen for the affair.
Did you start banging your head to the floor and saying, killer, killer, killer?
No.
Zamora says she wanted to verbally confront Jones and tell her to leave her boyfriend alone. She says Graham set up a meeting. That night, Zamora says Graham wanted to use her parents' car and told her to hide in the trunk. She says he picked up Jones and drove them to an isolated road. Zamora says there was a scuffle between Graham and Jones.
During the scuffle, did you ever hit Adrian Jones with a weight?
No, I didn't.
Zamora says Jones escaped through the window and ran to a field with Graham chasing her. An emotional Zamora described what happened next.
In the crook of his arm came down, I heard a gunshot go off immediately.
And what did David say to you at that point?
He told me she was dead.
Zamora repeatedly denied ordering, encouraging, or assisting in the crime. She says in the weeks after, Graham's violence against her escalated. The two later enrolled in separate military academies. Zamora says at the Naval Academy, she told other midshipmen about the crime as a way to get Graham out of her life. But the weekend before their arrest in September 1996, Zamora says she agreed to take the blame for everything.
The way we saw it, he still had a future at the Air Force Academy. And mine was pretty much over, and I didn't want to hurt his career.
As for her statements to authorities, Diane Zamora says she was denied legal representation. She testified her statement to Grand Prairie Police came only after a detective read her David Graham's confession. She says she told the detective she did not want to make a statement, but when pressed to do so, merely reiterated what David Graham had said. The defense questioned Diane Zamora all day on Tuesday. On Wednesday, she'll answer the questions from prosecutors. Deborah Ferguson, Texas News 5.
It was at all points a desperate move, but the two apparent lovebirds were pulling out all the stops to relieve themselves separately of the blame. It didn't pan out as though they would come to find. In the year 1998, both of the young lovers were found guilty of capital murder. Diane, convicted in February after 6.5 hours of deliberation, after which her family broke into tears. They, still believing in Diane's innocence, made a statement to thank the defense team for believing in her the same way they did. Meanwhile, David's case rolled into July, with his jury deliberating for 8 hours. True to form, Diane continued to show no reaction, surprise or otherwise, to the jury's decision in finding her guilty of the crime. Regardless of her repeated attempts to claim innocence, Adrian's grieving parents, still reeling from the loss of their lively teenager, spoke up in court to reflect their lack of reconciliation.
We will never know what heights she would have risen to because of this animal act.
My sister is very great. She meant a lot to me. And when she died, something was ripped out of my heart that will never be replaced.
I'll be able to remember my daughter with pride and joy for the rest of my life. I'm sorry that the Zamora family won't have that great memory.
For the Jones family, there was no solution, only justice. Not in the form of death, though. Instead, each was sentenced to life in prison on the day of their convictions, with Diane being housed in Mountain View Unit in Gatesville, Texas, and David winding up in Allred Prison, Iowa Park, Texas. The two devoted time to writing each other from their separate cells after their sentences were doled out, but the romance eventually died. The two, after all the hell they raised, had gone their separate ways. Diane, who still maintains her supposed innocence to this day, married another man, Stephen Mora. Stephen was a fellow inmate, and although they married in 2003, it wasn't long before she found herself divorced. Diane will be first eligible for parole in the fall of 2036. Same as her once fiancé, David. David, who also married in 2010, professes that his first confession in Colorado is the exact truth of the events that occurred back in 1995. In prison, David also pursued a bachelor's degree in criminology. Perhaps that interest was piqued when they discovered the legal system in a way he never expected to. But the facts of this case didn't stop David's attempt to move forward from the hellish crimes he and his once fiancée committed in the bedroom community of Mansfield in 1995. Thanks for listening to Devil We Know. If you want to support Devil We Know, please go to devilweknowpodcast.com. You can hit the donate button. Any donations are greatly appreciated. You can also join our Patreon, devilweknowpodcast.com. For $1, you get early access to these episodes, and they are also ad-free. And again, thank you so much for listening. And as always, stay safe.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky?
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.